brings us to the last case of the day, In Re Trust of Wilson and In Re Estate of Wilson.
May it please the court. My name is Nicole Seckman-Jillick, and along with my co-counsel, Jeffrey Blumel, we represent Luann Godding, who is a beneficiary under a will and trust. We're here today to ask the court to correct a few errors made by the trial court in this matter. First, the trial court erred in failing to remove the co-personal representatives of the trust. The will involved in the estate was a pour-over will, which directed
the co-personal representatives of the estate.
Correct. Thank you, Your Honor. To remove the co-personal representatives of the estate. The will involved in this estate was a pour-over will, which directed the co-personal representatives to deliver all the assets of the estate to the co-trustees.
So isn't that why the court determined that since it was a pour-over will, that any matters that were being contested could be addressed under the trust?
And that's true. However, that doesn't relieve the co-personal representatives' duties to amend an inventory, collect assets, and investigate the assets. You're right that the appellee's argument was that there was nothing more for the co-personal representatives to do, and therefore there was no reason to remove them. However, timing doesn't matter. Nebraska Statute 30-2454 states that a personal representative may be removed at any time. So even if there's just one tiny thing left for a personal representative to do, they still should be removed, especially when they've breached their duties. And there's ample evidence in this case that they have breached their duties. Much of the evidence that supports the removal of the co-trustees is the same evidence that supports the removal of the co-personal representatives. They failed to keep Luann informed. They failed to provide an accounting. They failed to answer her questions. They failed to amend the inventory and failed to collect assets and investigate the whereabouts of assets. Second of all, the court also erred by failing to award Luann her damages. Pursuant to the will and trust, Luann was entitled to receive income on an at least annual basis and one-third of the residue. She hasn't received either. It was error for the court not to award the payment of income and not the amount of the income. Exhibit 97, a demonstrative exhibit, actually showed that the income that Luann should have earned between 2010 and 2014 was $74,628. Exhibit 95 is an exhibit that shows how much residue Luann should have received under the terms of the will and the trust, and that amount was $100,243. The trial court erred in failing to award these damages. Trial court also erred in failing to fully surcharge the co-trustees and co-personal representatives for all amounts of missed payments, including payments for propane, insurance, electricity, a home remodeling project, windows, and personal property taxes. The appellees don't even contest that that Roseanne Wilson, one of the co-personal representatives and co-trustees, actually owned the personal property for which these personal property taxes were paid. And the court also failed to correctly tally the surcharges that it did award. In the court's order, it enumerated a number of surcharges against the co-trustees and stated that the surcharges totaled $73,675.88. However, if you actually total and calculate the items that they do list out, it actually totals $77,290.49.
Can you address the error you assigned regarding the court's failure to remove Roseanne and Roger as co-trustees of the subtrust? Was the removal of them as co-trustees not sufficient?
Correct. There is one trust instrument involved in this case, and it's attached to the operative petition. It creates the Henry Wilson Trust. It also contemplates the creation of this Luann Godding Trust. The same co-trustees that served as the Henry Wilson Trust were to serve as the Luann Godding Trust. The evidence in this case showed, however, although they filed deeding real property from the Henry Trust to the Luann Godding Trust, the trustees did nothing else to separately operate this trust. They didn't separately file tax returns. They didn't prepare separate accountings. There was no separate bank accounts. They continued to issue Schedule K-1s showing income in the name of Henry Trust. There was nothing done to separate the operation of the Henry Trust from the sub-trust. Even Damon Bohensky, one of the attorneys for the co-trustees and a partner of Mr. Bikey's, testified that the Henry Trust continued to operate for convenience. They found it convenient to not operate any separate trusts, sub-trusts, and therefore the trustees have breached their duties as acknowledged in the court's order, but they also should be removed from as trustees of the Luann Gauding Trust, especially since it's created under the same trust.
So when they were removed as co-trustees of the trust, weren't they at the same time removed as co-trustees of the sub-trust?
They should have been, and that's one of our arguments.
You're saying it wasn't automatic.
According to the court's order, that's not how we interpret the court's order, that she removed them also as trustees of the Luann Gauding Trust. There was also a few, we also believe that the court erred in a few evidentiary rulings, which also support this. There was some evidentiary rulings prohibiting the testimony and exhibits related to trust operations for the years of 2012, 13, 14, and 15. Some of this testimony was testimony from Bart Woodward, who was our expert witness who testified as to the reasonable rental rates in this case, which also supports Luann's claim for damages for income on this. As I mentioned before, there's clear evidence that the Henry Trust continued to operate well into these years. Leases for 2012 and 13 continued to be written stating that rent should be paid to the Henry Trust. Schedule K-1s, that's shown in Exhibit 102, continued to be issued in the name of the Henry Trust. There's evidence presented that bank accounts were only in the name of the Henry Trust, and therefore it was the court also erred in excluding some of the testimony and exhibits related to those trust operations. So trial court also erred and abused its discretion in failing to award Luann the full and reasonable amount of her attorney's fees. Luann requested the court award $189,000 in attorney's fees. However, the court abused its discretion in only awarding her $20,000 of attorney's fees. Further, Luann incurred over $24,000 of costs prosecuting this matter. She incurred costs for calling three expert witnesses to support her claim at trial, most of which she was successful on. Even the co-trustees and co-personal representatives and representatives themselves incurred over $61,000 in attorney's fees just to defend this case. And that's an amount that far exceeds what the court awarded to Luann. Everyone in this case, all the parties in this case, by agreement of the court, agreed to submit attorney's fees affidavit outside of the court hearing. The attorney's fees affidavits are Exhibit 124 and 125 in the Supplemental Bill of Exceptions. No objections to either exhibits were received. The appellees in their brief acknowledged they were presented and considered by the judge. They believe the judge thought that they, they argued that the judge thought they were excessive and duplicative, but the attorney's fees offered and considered by the judge in this matter do support Luann's request for reasonable attorney's fees in the amount of $189,000, and the court abused its discretion in failing to award that. The court also made an order that when the court did appoint a successor trustee, the court ordered that the beneficiaries pay the successor trustee's fees if assets are insufficient. It was also error for the court to enter that order. Beneficiaries are not indebted or not required to be indebted to a trust in which their bank account. But in addition, and also with respect to your question, Judge, about the sub-trusts, I just want to also make a point that no separate bank accounts were ever opened, no tax IDs, separate tax IDs were obtained for those sub-trusts. There was no separate tax returns and no separate accountings ever prepared for those sub-trusts. And as I mentioned, even the testimony of the co-trustee's own attorney admitted that for convenience purposes, those sub-trusts were not operated. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Larry Bikey. I represent the co-trustees and the personal co-representatives. I call it that because that's what the statute says. I don't necessarily agree. I can't talk as fast as I can't answer all her issues. However, let me address a couple. These sub-trusts, the petition doesn't mention the sub-trusts. It requests no relief related to the sub-trusts. It only asks for relief of the Henry Wilson Trust.
So you would agree that the removal of the co-trustees of the primary trust did not automatically mean removal of the sub-trust?
No.
So they still remain co-trustees of the sub-trust?
There's a pending action attempting to remove them in the same court. So no, this didn't affect that at all. It didn't come before the court. The court excluded that evidence. The court excluded the evidence as income evidence because it wasn't pleaded. The Henry Wilson Trust didn't cover that. The attorney fee issue. The appellants request a great deal of attorney fees. The statute, first of all, states that the court may award them as justice and equity requires. The standard we're looking at is an abuse of discretion standard. The Rolf Brenneman case cited in my brief indicates that you're faced with a cold record. The county court oversaw the litigation. The county court was in the best position to evaluate the litigation, determine if justice and equity require attorney fees, and in what amount. There is an issue I want to address. Well, first of all, let me say that I think the evidence presented, and I talk about this in my brief, there's a lot more to this case that expanded the amount of attorney fees. Those criteria don't necessarily say you get whatever you bill. There are other factors, a lot of other factors. I think the county court realized many of the allegations presented by the petitioner were unfounded. I think the court also realized that the co-trustees made a good faith effort to pay the obligations that they thought they should pay. This is a case of mistakes that were committed. It's not a case of intentional malfeasance. The plaintiff here has the burden of filing an affidavit or presenting other evidence of attorney fees. Okay? I will agree that I spoke with opposing counsel and agreed that affidavits could be presented in lieu of live testimony. However, you still have to make it part of the record, and it wasn't made part of the record here. This case is very, I went back and read the Cushman case, Judge Bishop, that you wrote a couple years ago. Very similar to that case, very similar. And I do recognize the court can still comb the record for an abuse of discretion, and I think that's what you have to do here. And ultimately, I think you're going to find there was no abuse of discretion in what the court awarded.
Those exhibits that you referenced, those are a part of our record.
I'm sorry?
Those exhibits that you just mentioned on the attorney fees are a part of our record in the Supplemental Bill of Exceptions.
Right, but isn't it kind of like instructions that are refused? They also become part of the record, but they're not utilized by the court.
But do we have a stipulation before us?
No, there was no stipulation. There was nothing making it a part of the actual record. We had no hearing, we had no stipulation. There was only a motion and those affidavits.
So no hearing at which they were accepted into evidence?
No.
And it wasn't agreed that they would be received into evidence?
You know, I thought long and hard about this, and I think the only thing we talked about was the fact that we would have affidavits in lieu of live testimony. Nothing beyond that, in my recollection. Let me say something about the removal of the personal co-representatives.
Yeah.
There's really no need for that. The court saw this. We were at a point before this litigation started that we were ready to close the estate. The court made some adjustments, the county court, that we had to incorporate into the estate documents. We had to redo the inventory a little bit, and then we're ready to close. That's all we need to do. It's ready to present to the court and close. If the court wanted to remove us as personal co-representatives, fine, but what's the person going to do? Just submit the same documents to the court and the estate will be closed. There's really no reason to do that. The court took care of the matter in the trust action. That's all I have. If there are other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
No further questions.
Thank you.
How much time does the appellant have remaining?
1 minute and 14 seconds.
Your Honor, to address the appellee's argument that these exhibits in 124 and 125 for attorney's fees were contemplated to be accepted as evidence in this matter simply doesn't make sense. Like I said, by agreement of the parties and by agreement with the judge, she agreed that it would make sense to offer these outside of a hearing. They were submitted to the judge, and it would just not make sense to contemplate that they wouldn't be evidence given the motions filed in this case and given the nature of this case. Mr. Beige contends that the fees were excessive and not reasonable. Well, one of the reasons that the fees were so large in this case has to do with the stonewalling of the co-personal representatives and of the co-trustees. The appellant had to fight to get every piece of information in this case. It's the personal representatives and trustees' job and their duty to voluntarily provide information to beneficiaries. It's part of their fiduciary duty. Even one of our expert witnesses, Richard Raby, testified that this information should be voluntarily provided, but it wasn't. So our client had to incur attorney's fees in order to obtain this information. We even had to take the deposition of one of the co-trustees to learn information. Thank you for yes.
Obviously, 124 and 125, it was agreed that they'd be marked because we're calling them 124 and 125.
Correct.
But was it agreed they'd be received?
Correct.
It was, and that's in the record?
They were offered to the judge outside of a hearing. It was by oral agreement of the parties in an oral discussion that those would be submitted as evidence for the judge to consider. And even in the appellee's brief, they do acknowledge they were considered by the judge.
There's nothing in the record where the court states, I'm receiving exhibits 124 and 125.
I'm not aware of that.
No further questions? Thank you, counsel. You are excused and the case is submitted. And seeing that the students left us, I guess we are now in adjournment.